Sri asked me to come today to give a talk a bit about asteroids and other moving things in the solar system. And it would be really easy to give a incredibly dry talk about asteroids and tell you that there are 4,000 known near-Earth asteroids, and about 1,000 of those are bigger than 1 kilometer, and there are, you know, this number of main belt asteroids and stuff. But that would put me to sleep, especially given what time I had to get up this morning. So instead, I thought we'd actually start with looking for things that move. These are three images taken with the 48-inch telescope at Palomar and Mike Brown's survey for Kuiper Belt objects. We'll come back to that outer solar system stuff for actually most of the talk. Taken over the course of 2 hours, so an hour apart between images. And there are a bunch of things you should notice immediately. First of all, there's things like meteors and satellites. Main belt asteroids show up really easily. They move rapidly when you're looking at the opposition point. The whole reason I'm showing you this image, actually you won't even be able to, well, I can pick it out because I know where it is, but we'll come back to it in a bit. But the point being that no matter where you look in the sky, you're going to be seeing things that are solar system moving. So let's start inside. Here are the four rocky planets with Mars on the outside. There's a whole bunch of near-Earth asteroids. And for those of you who are designing surveys, the thing to think about with near-Earth asteroids is they move fast a lot of the time. They can be, if you're not having a high cadence, they can be in one image and not in the image before and not in the image after. So you need to, this is the one of the two themes I want you to think about coming out of this talk if you're designing any surveys. One is you need to worry about moving objects. You need to be finding them in order to avoid thinking that they're false, or thinking that they're positive for whatever you're looking for. And the second I'll come to in a moment. So near-Earth asteroids, they can move tens of arc seconds per hour. If in fact, you're lucky if they're moving really fast, because then they streak out and you can just ignore them. Zooming out, we have the main belt of asteroids that's so familiar. Here's Jupiter's orbit and the massive number of moving objects there. And so if you're anywhere down near the ecliptic, you're going to see a lot of them and they're going to get in your way. The second big thing for those of you who are observing that I want you to take away is that things don't always move the way you want. A lot of times if you sit in our Kuiper Belt talks where we're talking about finding these things that are moving, all the asteroids are easy to see because they're just dotting along fast across the images and you can ignore them. But that's because we're looking out at the opposition point. Here's a random asteroid I chose to plot up, and what you see is its motion over the course of one observing season over here in RA and DAC, but then its rate of motion in RA and DAC. And notice it goes right through 0, 0. There's a lot of asteroids have stationary points or very close to stationary points where if you happen to be pointed there, it's going to look like some other type of transient to you, especially if you're not checking for asteroids or if your cadence is too long. And unlike the opposition point, which is always in the same place in the sky, figure out where the sun is, look the other direction, the stationary point is different for every asteroid. So here's Earth, and the opposition point's obviously out here, and that's where we do most of our Kuiper Belt searches and such. But the stationary points for asteroids are going to be more like in cones this direction. So you need to think about when you're choosing where you're looking or choosing what time of year you're looking at fields for moving on, or for your stationary transients, you need to think about moving. You need to think about asteroids, and that asteroids will be at their stationary points. You can also see here the other classes of asteroids, like the Trojans there and there. But let's keep moving outward because that's what actually interests me. This is a figure based on a thought that Kuiper had many decades ago and a number of other people noticed, which is if you take all the mass in the solar system and you smear it out, coming out from the sun, out to the edge of the solar system, you would expect that there might be something else out here besides Pluto. Pluto is way undermassive, and that resulted in the prediction of the Kuiper Belt. And until about 15 years ago, nobody had found any of those. We now know of something like 1,000 of those. Here is Neptune's orbit coming inward with the four gas giants. There are several things on this figure to take away. First of all, you can see where the galactic plane is because it's hard to find Kuiper Belt objects in the galactic plane. But second, the most important thing is that there's an outer edge to the Kuiper Belt out here, and that's not an observational effect. Obviously, things go to the fourth power as you go outward for brightness, so it's harder to find Kuiper Belt objects further out. But this effect is real. There really is an outer edge to the Kuiper Belt. And that is part of what really drew me into this outer solar system, was wondering what else is out there and what could it tell us about the early history of the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple different categories of Kuiper Belt objects. There's the what we call the cold classical, because their orbits aren't terribly excited. So those are typically down in the plane, and they are in relatively low eccentricity orbits also. And so therefore, a lot of the surveys have been sticking very, very close to the ecliptic, which for a variety of reasons isn't exactly the plane of the Kuiper Belt, but it's close enough that that's where most Kuiper Belt objects have been found. But most of them have been found there because that's where most people have looked. So like the Deep Ecliptic Survey that has found, I think it's now something like 850 of the 1,000 or 1,500 known Kuiper Belt objects, was trying to stay within 3 or 4 degrees of the ecliptic. Other surveys have tried, one other survey, Mike Brown's survey with the 48-inch, has gone way off the ecliptic by trying to cover the whole sky, but to less deep magnitude. The other categories of Kuiper Belt objects include the things that are in resonances, like the Plutinos that are in the same resonance as Pluto with Neptune. Some of those can have decent inclinations. And then the scattered disk objects can have very high inclinations. Yeah. So an edge. Oh, you can also see an observational effect in here from how some people have done their surveys, like this and this. And this, those are pencil beam surveys, so most of those are going to be very, very small little Kuiper Belt objects that just happen to be in the beam. So there's Pluto for reference, the most famous Kuiper Belt object. Well, do you doubt it's the most famous?
No.
I don't think about Sedna.
Yeah, actually, I should be careful what I say, because I'm, Sri knows this, but I'm just accepting a job at Lowell Observatory. So I need to be very careful with my words about Pluto nowadays. With Kuiper Belt objects, you face the same stationary point problem. This is just, I literally just typed in a random number that I knew would be a Kuiper Belt object and pulled this up. So this is over one observing season. It moves a little bit in RA and DAC. Most of that motion is due to Earth's motion when you get out that far. We're looking for Kuiper Belt objects using the reflex motion. And typically, Kuiper Belt objects at that distance, you're seeing a couple arc seconds per hour rate of motion when you look at the opposition point. So let's see, the start of the observing season is this point on this rate of motion plot. Opposition point is here where it's moving the fastest, and then the end of the observing season. But if you were to look at the wrong time, it just wouldn't be moving at all. Here's the fighting words. Here's the object that's larger than Pluto, and some want to call the 10th planet. And if Pluto's a planet, then this thing has to be a planet too. And notice it doesn't actually go through a perfect stationary point, and that's because it's on a very highly inclined orbit. It's just about the most inclined Kuiper Belt object found yet. But it's so far much further out that its maximum rate of motion is smaller. So let's talk about how these Kuiper Belt objects are found in that particular survey, which is the 48-inch survey by Mike Brown at Palomar Observatory using this telescope, the Ocean Telescope. And its big trick is it can only get down to about 21st magnitude, which most Kuiper Belt objects are a good bit fainter than that. But the important part of what this can do is the wide area coverage, much larger than anything currently in existence. Obviously, things coming along like PanSTARRS and LSST will blow everything we're doing today out of the water. But for now, this is the way to go for finding these biggest Kuiper Belt objects. So one field of view is something like 4 square degrees, covered with like about 112 CCD chips mosaic together. This is that image I started with. Here, the triplet, the same. There's a main belt asteroid up there, and buried in here. And I would bet a good bit of money that nobody in the audience could find it, and I could only find it because I know where it is. Is what's that? Do you know where? I don't have a...
No, it must be transferred.
Give it to someone else.
See, the point, the audience knows everything. Three.
So buried in here until we announced Xena.
I don't think you feel bad. Someone pointed out.
Buried in here is the largest KBO that was found before Xena, and except for Pluto, obviously. So zooming in, it'll blink. Yeah, now it's easy. So, yeah, now it's easy that it's centered on it. Yeah. But so this is like 15% of a square degree in this one field. Obviously, we don't do any eye blinking. We do it all with automated software that we've written over the years. And there it is. And that is Quawar, which is a very normal circular orbit here, a very standard Kuiper Belt object. The only thing that makes it stand out is its size. It's getting up towards Pluto size. And for those of us who are studying these icy objects out in the solar system, when you start looking at the spectrum, its surface is very interesting, looking more like Pluto than anything. Yeah, it's amazing what you can do nowadays with the
telescope. Such a BS.
Is that assuming same albedo for Pluto and these new objects?
In Quawar's case, it's actually the size has been measured directly. Most of these objects, you have to make an assumption about albedo. In some cases, they are bright enough in the thermal to do a measurement with like Spitzer in the thermal infrared and in the visible, and use those two measurements combined to fit an albedo. But there are a lot of model assumptions that go into that and make everyone relatively uncomfortable who thinks about it for any amount of time. There are things like, the simple things are the pole position. If the pole's pointed at you, then it is quite different than if the pole is a rapid rotator and able to radiate to full space. A few Kuiper Belt objects have been able to be measured directly in size. They're large enough angular size to do it with HST in comparison to a stellar PSF. Mike Brown's done that for the three or four that are possible. And then the others that have been directly are a couple of occultations. Pluto and Charon have been done that way. And certainly these large new ones that we've been finding recently will be done in the near future that way.
And then to ask a short mm-hmm. question the other way around. So now that you have the sizes, are albedos fairly similar or they're right?
No. I'm not gonna talk about 2003 UV313 much today, but the paper is coming out sometime relatively soon, and its albedo is like 90%. The standard Kuiper Belt albedo for a long time has been more like down at 5%, depending on who you talk to. UV313 looks like it is the brightest patches of Pluto, and just cover the whole planet with it. And Pluto itself has the most. Thanks. Pluto itself has the most varied surface in the solar system in terms of dark to light contrast.
Let's try to postpone
the
questions.
Okay. So. That was Quawar and a relatively normal Kuiper Belt object. Here's something that showed up a couple years ago in this survey. And for quite a while, we weren't really sure whether it was real. It was actually about 6 or 8 weeks of trying to get confirmation observations. And you'd get something where there was a cosmic ray nearby, and you just wouldn't quite be sure. But the thing you should notice is that, well, I didn't give you any scale bars, so maybe you shouldn't. But it's moving a lot more slowly than Quawar in those last images. And that object was Sedna, which would be interesting by itself for its size, that it's larger than Quawar, it's getting up towards the size of Pluto, as the artist is trying to imply here. It's extremely red. But the really interesting thing about Sedna, and what truly convinced me to jump from working on things like Titan's atmosphere and weather to working in the Kuiper Belt, was where Sedna is. Here's all those, the 1,000 or so known KBOs, their locations. And remember I said there's an outer edge to the Kuiper Belt, and that is an outer edge, not so much in where they are at any given moment, but an outer edge to their perihelia. That you can have Kuiper Belt objects in eccentric orbits that can take them out hundreds of AU. But all of their perihelia are inside about 47 AU or so. And that's the effect that you're seeing here. Well, here's Sedna, and it's already pretty far out there. And here's Sedna's orbit. Its perihelion is something like almost twice what a typical Kuiper belt, you know, what this edge of the Kuiper belt object is. You can't form Sedna the same way you form KBOs. You can't lift it up that way. You can lift up the aphelion, you can lift it up and push that out with resonances with Neptune, but you can't lift the perihelion from Neptune or other forces within the solar system that we've been using to we've been invoking for the Kuiper belt. And its orbit's not eccentric enough for typical things like galactic tides or other passing stars to be lifting up the perihelion once you've got it this eccentric. You have to come up with some new scenario to describe how it got there. And there's four or five different favorite stories to explain it. One is that you have an unseen Mars mass planet at something like 70 AU. And that would be able to take a typical Kuiper belt object and lift it up to an orbit like Sedna. And if that was the case, then and that there were many more objects than Sedna, then you would expect that all their perihelia line up at about 76 AU. Another scenario is that you had a very close encounter with a single star, which it needs to be close enough that under current galactic conditions, the probability of that is extremely low over the age of the solar system. But if you have that close encounter of a very specific geometry, you can lift Sedna up into its orbit. And if you had that close encounter, it would have lifted other objects up into orbits. And they wouldn't line up like this, because of course precession is going to blur them out. But the signature is going to be very clear. If you look at each object and look for the required geometry of a close encounter, they're all going to line up and tell you that, if you can find more of these objects. Another possibility is that the stellar cluster we were born in, it was denser than we thought, and we had numerous lesser encounters early on, and that lifted KBOs up into Sedna's orbit, and that would lead to a more isotropic population. Another possibility that I don't have up here is that it was actually captured from one of these encounters off of the Kuiper belt of another star. And Kenyon and Bromley have done some work recently showing that that would lead to very high inclination orbits in general. So you would see that signature if you can find more of these objects. Go ahead and skip ahead to here. If you can find more of these objects. So here's every Kuiper belt object known so far on a plot of the motion at the time it was discovered versus our magnitude. And most of the previous surveys have cut off and been motion limited about 2 arcseconds per hour. If the seeing's really good, maybe they got down to 1.5 arcseconds. And here's UB313, and here's Sedna, slow, but there's all the Kuiper belt objects are faster. The surveys are not motion limited for them. They could have detected slower ones, but they're not just going slow enough to actually pick up these Sedna-like objects that we want to find to distinguish between those fundamentally different scenarios for what happened early on in the solar system. So what we've started doing is a new survey at the Palomar 200-inch looking for objects out in this region of the phase space, and we can get down to about 24th magnitude, and using a 24-hour time baseline instead of just an hour baseline, we get down to rates of much less than, you know, good bit less than 0.1 arcsecond per hour. And with that survey, we haven't found anything yet. There's a couple of problems with Palomar and the large format camera that we're using that limit how much area of the sky we've actually covered. We've covered a couple of hundred square degrees down to 22nd magnitude, and a few dozen square degrees down to 24th magnitude, which isn't yet deep enough to have actually found any of these Sedna-like objects, given our expectations about their population. But if we can cover something like 1,000 square degrees, or a little bit more than that, down to 24th magnitude, we expect to find 10 to 50 of these objects. And that's a really interesting number. In astronomy, you make your leaps forward when you get an order of magnitude more objects. When you went from having 10 Kuiper belt objects to having 100, you made a fundamental leap in your understanding of how the KBOs got there. And again, when you went from 100 to 1,000, you suddenly understood these different populations and how they might have gotten out there in their formation history. Right now, we have one Sedna-like object. If we can get to something like 10, we can tell the first chapter of the story of what was happening in the earliest part of the solar system and how it left its signature in this outer part of the solar system. Surveys coming along in the future, like LSST and PanSTARRS, will take over, but they're some years away, and they will find hundreds of these if they do it, if they do their survey right. But in the meantime, there's an opportunity to find 10 to 50 of them and really tell something interesting about the earliest ages of the solar system. The other very interesting prospect would be if Sedna, if you take the size distribution of the Cape Kuiper Belt and you make a prediction about what else is out there based on your one data point of Sedna, there should be Mars massed objects out there, one or two of them. And if you can find them, that would be spectacular. And I would predict that in 20 to 25 years, we'll know of a Mars sized object in the outer solar system. Thank you. Thanks.
Any questions? Sure.
So, for most of the audience, you know, these are the fog.
These are noise, yes.
Yeah.
Like I feel about asteroids.
So, with all these, you know, stationary points, this and that, I mean, most interesting trends, it'll be one in, you know, 1,000. I mean, so it always pulls them, you know. So, is the approach where we do simultaneous two color imaging the best way to decrease up?
How would simultaneous two-color imaging?
I don't know. These things have colors, you know, which are like blue and red.
Yeah, they have a range. Zena is, or UB313 is just white. It's gray. It's flat. And, well, it's white at 0.9 albedo. Sedna is incredibly red. So I don't think you'll be able to distinguish these by color. You can certainly, although the stationary points aren't all the same for each of these, you can certainly sort of define ranges of avoidance on the sky that are most likely to have, you know, the main belt asteroids. There's only a cone on the sky where a circular orbit would be in a stationary point at that in that region. The other factors, if you're away from the ecliptic, objects that have decent inclination don't have the same level of, they don't come as close to a stationary point because they continue to move in ecliptic latitude. So as long as you stay away from the ecliptic, first of all, you cut your number of asteroids and of classical Kuiper Belt objects that you have to worry about. You also make it be that the stationary point isn't as truly stationary.
Are they all pretty spherical, or you could get some ellipsoidal rotational variability?
Are what, sorry?
Are these bodies fairly spherical, or?
Most of the large ones are. Sedna, or not Sedna, Santa, sorry, we have nicknames within our group. Santa, which is a 2003 EL61, is actually incredibly elongated out into a almost football shape. And this is an object that is almost the size of Pluto. It's bizarre. Everything else, we haven't seen anything else like that that makes
us... Does it vary because of the rotors?
Yeah, that's how we figured that out. It had like 4/10 of a magnitude variation and a very rapid rotation.
I'm going to use my prerogative to ask a question, then I'm going to go to Ren. Do these things, can you use the weak scintillation to distinguish between stars and these planets, or are they, is the Brunel size something you can talk about in coffee, but would these things twinkle, is what I'm asking?
No, they wouldn't cover enough, I don't think, of the sky, most of them. Certainly
no,
small.
I'm saying the scintillation caused by the interplanetary medium.
Oh, I don't know.
Stars twinkle as they're viewed through the mm-hmm. Earth's atmosphere. Planets don't.
Right. I don't think these are.
These are 2 points.
I think they're. I think the answer is except for the largest.
Than the Fresnel scale alone.
Right.
Like,
do you know if any retrograde motion equivalent?
No. We have none that. No. But there's hints that there are a couple. The Deep Ecliptic Survey reported a couple of odd, backward moving objects that they didn't follow up. Nobody typically looks for retrograde. I've just started actually my software including that possible, allowing for it, which means a little bit higher false positive rate, but it's acceptable.
Josh? So I understand how discovery of these things would be aided by having, you know, the same telescope with the same instrumentation looking at the same part of the sky with whatever cubes. But is it possible, and have you conceived of sort of getting a consortium of many telescopes together, sort of publishing only the catalogs rather than the images and letting, you know, someone work on making these cross comparisons?
Yeah, data mining. We've thought long and hard about that and have taken steps towards making that easier in the future, like the the 48-inch survey, its magnitude limit is conveniently somewhat close to what the USNOB 1.0 limit is, and so we keep every object that doesn't line up with USNOB 1.0 or with a known asteroid. We just sort of store that away in a file for someday when we have the right graduate student. But yeah, so that is, we are constantly thinking about how can we use other people's data sets to either, you know, do pre-coveries of things that we found, or eventually do big look, you know, big searches for things that are really far away.
Any more questions? The coffee's hot.
Obviously, I think as you talked about that there's the 50 AU cutoff, but do you think there's any selection effect from obviously that the only coverable objects you're going to be seeing are those that are able to reflect light? For anything that's less than 100 millimeters at 30, 50 AU, you're not going to see any of the light.
Yeah, that was a big debate early on when the statistics were dozens. At this point, with 1,000 of them, there's no question because we could have seen those objects further out now. You know, even with them being demo, we could have seen the 500 kilometer objects in the 55 AU orbit at this point.
But anything less than 500, so meaning 100 kilometers or less.
There are small things that could be missing from out there, but it's the important thing to remember is that the pileup is in perihelion, not an actual current distance when you find it. That you will see when you look at that figure, 47 AU is actually in the mass of objects, and it's just that the perihelia are all piled up.
I see a question from over here. Was it Ed?
It has nothing to do with the survey itself, but you said that you have this one Kuiper Belt object which is bigger than Pluto but is extended, and I cannot understand how this is possible, because with gravity you would think it's too big to not be round, so I cannot understand.
It's not quite bigger than Pluto, but that doesn't change the fantastical nature of this object.
It must be fluffy or something.
What it looks like. Oh, and we have the lovely thing with that is we have a moon around it, so we know its density. And it's rock. We have a spectrum of the surface, and it's water ice. So it looks like the story that to tell about that is something like actually the formation of the Earth and the Moon. Of you had a giant collision that sent this thing, you know, that melted everything, sent all the volatiles go flying off, you know, and that sent it spinning rapidly, and it froze into shape. And then you had a little bit of volatiles freeze back onto the surface. It's a bizarre object. It really is.
Okay, so it's made of rock underneath, so its known surface is elevated. It's obvious, it's Canada.
She shot it.
I have a question going back yesterday. Errol, that you mentioned there might be retrograde objects. Does that support any of those formation scenarios for the Solstice Divide Squid Mollop?
I don't recall seeing mention of what retrograde would imply for any of those. I would think that capture would be if you found a bunch of retrograde, capture would be the only one of those four that I just presented that would be likely, unless you were doing something like taking the inclination, actually flipping it over. But I would think if you started finding a bunch of retrograde sudden-like objects, yeah, capture is the answer.
One question here.
Going back to that bizarre object, can you exclude the possibility that you have inhomogeneous albedo, say one side is black, the other one is white, it rotates, and it fools you into thinking that it's elongated?
You can't quite do that with the rotation period. Yeah, you can't pull that off. It's just outside that limit. To maintain that we know the density also. You have to be consistent with the density, you have to be consistent with the light curve, and you can't put enough mass inside what you would have to be to do that.
Okay. No further questions. Let's thank all the speakers this morning.